Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
ASA is the only major trade association that represents soybean producers in the United States.
Kyle Kunkler is Director of Government Affairs with ASA, the American Soybean Association.
ASA represents over 500,000 soybean farmers across 30 different soybean producing states. It's actually one of the largest grower organizations in the United States, and engages pretty closely with a lot of other organizations, both in Washington, D.C. at the state level, to make sure that soybean farmers, their interests are being represented both at the national level and at the state level, and their trade-related needs are being represented as well.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There's actually a lot going on right now regarding Endangered Species Act that I'm often just sort of surprised how few folks are aware of what's going on.
Kyle Kunkler is Director of Government Affairs with the American Soybean Association, or ASA. He's talking about the Endangered Species Act, or ESA.
It's probably going to have very profound impacts on the ability of pesticide users, farmers and otherwise, to access pesticide moving forward. EPA, again, this is one of those laws that Congress enacted that is well-intentioned. It was enacted in 1973, and Congress intended that any sort of federal activities wouldn't harm endangered species or their habitats. And that's pretty easy to do when you're thinking about something like, you know, say, Department of Transportation building a bridge over a creek and there's an endangered turtle in the creek. How can we make sure that that turtle is protected? Well, you know, first of all, we got to figure out, one, is it going to be harmed? And if so, two, how can we protect it? Maybe the answer is, you know, moving the bridge, you know, a quarter mile downstream. But in the case of pesticides, what you're not talking about a simple bridge over a creek. You're talking about a tool that's used on, you know, registered on dozens of crops, used across hundreds of millions of acres, and it might intersect with all 1,600 different endangered species. And when EPA is trying to figure out if that's going to have an impact on species, and that, and then hundreds of other pesticides that might be registered, it becomes a gargantuan task, one that's very, very difficult for the agency. And so what they're increasingly looking at is trying to figure out, well, how can we become compliant? And they're being backed into corners by frequent lawsuits. They're going to have to do something. But, you know, some of the solutions that they're thinking up is, you know, putting in place, say, like upfront cookie cutter restrictions that might work well for protecting species, but are really going to risk jeopardizing the ability of farmers to continue to access these essential tools.
Says one of the questions is whether or not producers can find solutions with EPA, especially with herbicides.
What EPA is proposing is requiring farmers or applicators to adopt a certain number of what they call points, efficacy points for runoff. And the way that you get those points, well, first of all, you have to figure out what your point needs are. And it's very complicated under this proposal. It depends on what crops you're growing, what herbicides you're using, what your soil type looks like, what your proximity to species are. The formula to figure this out, honestly, is probably better suited for a math textbook than it is a pesticide label. But when you finally can figure out how many points you need, and what we're figuring on average, it's between 6 and 9 points. You then have to figure out, well, how can I become compliant? And EPA gives you a whole bunch of different conservation practices that you have to adopt to reduce your runoff or your spray drift risks. And that can be things like, you know, some of them may not be too tough. It could be things like adopting reduced tillage. And that might get you a point or two. But then it could be things like putting in place 30-foot riparian buffers or contour terracing or grass waterways or vegetative filter strips. And very quickly, it becomes incredibly costly and difficult for growers to meet the number of points that they might need to continue to use herbicides under this proposal.
That's Kyle Kunkler, Director of Government Affairs with ASA. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Both beef and pork exports to Mexico are up sharply in 2023, with pork on a record pace, up 14% over last year on volume. Beef shipments are up 17% on volume and 25% on value. U.S. Meat Export Federation's director in Mexico and Central America, Gerardo Rodriguez, says they have been working to broaden the cuts available to keep both beef and pork at the center of the plate.
We are using the chuck for those kind of restaurants that they usually use when work on the loins, which they are price sensitive. But what we want to keep it is the U.S. beef, in this case, to be the center of the plate and not the price to be the driver of the decision. We want you to understand that the product that you are getting from the U.S. has consistency and it has quality.
USMEF has been taking semi-trucks with mobile kitchens across the country to introduce decision-makers and influencers to new cuts and recipes.
We have been working with over 800 decision-makers around the country in order to work with them and introduce these new options that they can use in their gastronomy through the pork truck or through the U.S. beef truck that we have. So having these kind of people, decision makers, and they can stream the information going downstream in their establishment, in the restaurants, in their hotels, is very important for us. So the more knowledgeable, the more information we can provide them, and the more engaged that we can make them, is the easier for us. And this is not a matter of just a price. Once you understand the quality, once you understand the consistency and the benefit for your company and your restaurant and your point of sale about the good product that you're buying from the U.S., price is not going to be the main driver.
U.S. pork and beef promotions in Mexico are made possible through support from USDA, the National Pork Board, and the Beef Checkoff Program. USDA announced it will make funds available through the Commodity Credit Corporation for a regional agricultural promotion program to expand opportunities for U.S. agricultural products in international markets. U.S. Meat Export Federation President and CEO Dan Hallstrom welcomed the news and said it's very timely as the Agricultural Trade Promotion Program is coming to an end.
USMEF would definitely like to thank Secretary Vilsack, staff at USDA, and congressional leaders that support this program through the CCC, prioritizing international market development. We're excited about the opportunity. The ATP, or the Agricultural Trade Promotion Program, that was put out 4 years ago that finishes up next year, USMEF's actually finished up our program, the ATP program, earlier this year. And that has just been phenomenal in terms of the opportunity to create additional value for our members and our pork and beef producers all over the country. The fact that there's another opportunity here will allow USMEF and other cooperators in other parts of agriculture in the U.S. to maintain some of this momentum in the export markets.
Hallstrom said the additional funding could be especially helpful in emerging markets.
The ATP, or the Agricultural Trade Promotion Program, allowed us to not only overcome some of the trade obstacles that we had at that time, but allowed us to go into some of the newer markets around the world and really establish a footprint. Colombia, for example, where we were able to get aggressive. Also, the Philippines was another area on beef and pork where we were able to get aggressive. We would have been involved in these markets anyway, but not nearly to the extent that we ended up being able to invest in those markets. And these emerging markets are where really the opportunity is long term. And whatever we can do today to invest for the future, there's no doubt that there'll be payback over time.
I'm John Harreth.
Thanks, John. And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
96th, the National FFA Convention and Expo, joined by Philip Youngman, a staff sergeant with the U.S. Army and an Olympian. What brings an Olympian to National FFA Convention?
Yeah, so we're here with the U.S. Army Marksmanship Unit. We travel around to different big events trying to show that there's more to the Army than just being an infantryman. You know, that's only like 1% of the jobs. There's actually 150 different jobs that are in the Army. So what we do is we go out and we try to show these kids what kind of opportunities the Army can provide to them here for some FFA folks.
Tell us a little bit about the booth. The Marksmanship Unit is what you're here with. Tell us a little bit about that.
With the Army Marksmanship Unit, we actually have four jobs. The first one's kind of obvious. We try to go to competitions and compete and win gold medals. And then we use our gold medalists to advertise, like I'm doing here at the FFA convention. That's our second job, is to kind of show what the Army has to offer. Our third job is we go around to different units within the military, and we teach them how to shoot, and we build different doctrinal books that are describing how the best techniques are to shoot so that we can build a more lethal army. And then the fourth of those is we have a fantastic gunsmithing team that does lots of research and development and helps us to kind of support what we try to do on the Olympic stage.
Tell us a little bit about your path in the Army. Did you join thinking that you wanted to compete, or how did you end up with, you know, an Olympic, going to the Olympics?
Yeah, so it started off, I actually was in FFA, just like a lot of these kids. I was the parliamentarian of my local chapter, and I didn't really do too much with the FFA as far as shooting-wise. It wasn't really as strong in my area, but I did show a lot. And then after high school, I went to Texas A&M, and I actually ended up in the middle of my college career leaving college to go to join the Army. I missed the Olympics in 2016, and I missed it by one slot. So the Army saw that and thought that that was a lot of potential in me, so they decided to hire me then from being an Olympic alternate in hopes that I make it to the Olympics.
So what did it look like? You competed in the 2020 Olympics then?
That's correct.
What did that look like?
It was the COVID Olympics. So, you know, the COVID hits in May of 2020. It was a little bit of a roller coaster for me because I made the team. Immediately after I made the team, within a week, the whole world shut down, and they said that the Olympics was canceled. And there's nothing more disappointing than going through the roller coaster of making it for the first time ever, you know, your lifelong goal of making it to the Olympics. And then after that, getting told within a week that you're no longer going to the Olympics because they've been closed down. Well, then soon after that, they decided that they're no longer closed down. They were going to be postponed by a year. And then I got all happy and giddy inside again because I'd be able to go. But then the topic arose that maybe we would have to retry out and see who gets to go again. So then back down the roller coaster again, I'm not even sure if I'm going to be the one going to the Olympics anymore. And then the final peak of the roller coaster, the board actually accepted that we would be going. So the COVID Olympics, you know, my family couldn't go. I would have loved for them to be there. You know, it's a life event, and it kind of sucks that they couldn't go. There was no people in the stands, you know, so it didn't really have the same atmosphere as a normal Olympics. But it is the Olympics, and you're still standing shoulder to shoulder with some of the best people on the planet. So it's really cool to sit there talking to people that are in track and field, you know, the fastest, you know, tallest, most athletic people you've ever been around. So it's really cool.
And you guys could come recruit anywhere. Why is FFA convention a beneficial place to come recruit students?
I feel like the goal and the mission of FFA just really kind of shows through the kids. The kids come in and they have all of these skills with being outdoors and, you know, being a part of a group. And those are all skills that really translate well to the Army. So it's kind of something that the Army sees the connection, and they love coming out and supporting this event.
For National FFA, I'm Michelle Stengler.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Definitely not by the November 17th deadline when the current continuing resolution expires and government funding runs out.
Tanner Beamer, Senior Director, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
You know, I've been joking with my colleagues that in terms of how close the House and Senate are in their respective appropriations bills, I'd say the House of Representatives is in Washington, D.C., and the Senate's in Neptune. They could not be farther apart. For example, just if you look at the Department of Agriculture, right, that bill has been considered in both the House and the Senate, failed in the House, and passed in the Senate last week. The Senate version of the bill gave USDA a modest increase over fiscal 23 enacted levels. You look at the House version of the bill, and it already imposed deep cuts when it came out of committee, but it got amended on the floor to include even more draconian cuts to key programs over at USDA. And that's one of the reasons why farm state Republicans joined together to stop that bill from advancing. So, you know, we've got a long way to go in terms of reconciliation between the House and the Senate. But I am optimistic that at some point between now and the end of the year, we will see all 12 appropriations bills get passed into law, conference between the House and the Senate, and some sort of a deal sent to President Biden's desk. Now, that being said, I think it's going to take one or two more continuing resolutions in order to do that. And I might be being a little bit more optimistic, but hey, that's what I'm here for.
But it seems as though the deficit and an attempt to cut spending is driving every conversation.
Every single Republican in the House of Representatives, let's just take that by itself for a moment. Every single Republican in the House wants to see a curb to federal spending. I mean, we were absolutely out of control during the coronavirus pandemic and a year's following, just spending money that we didn't have. And I think that House Republicans want to change that. The degree to which they want to change it and how fast they want to change it varies drastically depending on whether you're talking about moderate Republicans from suburban districts or extreme right Republicans in the Freedom Caucus. And that really is where the vast majority of the debate is unfolding right now. And that's just one party in one chamber. Once you start throwing in trying to make a debt commission bipartisan and bicameral, there's a lot of other elements that you have to consider as well. And unfortunately, just the way that 118th Congress is shaking out, it does not look like there are a whole lot of opportunities for bipartisan cooperation on things like this. So I don't know how successful Speaker Johnson's going to be in terms of making those things bipartisan. But I do think that if he is able to bring Republicans together around a centralized plan to cut spending that all of them can agree to and hold to that agreement, that will have been worth its time in and of itself.
And then there's the expiration of the 2018 Farm Bill.
The same political undertones that we were just talking about with respect to spending and appropriations is the exact same that we'll have to look at when examining the Farm Bill. The House and the Senate are going to be miles apart from one another. But I think one encouraging thing vis-a-vis the Farm Bill, all four of what we call the four corners, the chairs and ranking members of the House and Senate Ag Committees, have said that they are supportive of a one-year extension of the 2018 Farm Bill. And that obviously is not ideal, especially on the Title I side of the equation. There are some commodities in desperate need of reference price increases from 2018 just based upon inflationary pressures and the value of the dollar and the increase in input costs from then to now. But I think that a temporary extension is going to be a Band-Aid solution on this critical issue. But unfortunately, just given the political dynamics that we're seeing play out on Capitol Hill, I think that's probably the best solution that we can hope for the time being. Speaker Johnson is still very new to this. Now, NCBA has had a relationship with him and his office since he first came to Congress, and we are very confident in his ability to move legislation through the House of Representatives. But, you know, there is a Senate to contend with as well, and a president who has to either sign the bill or veto it.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Some of our purebred producers may be starting to calve in February, particularly with their replacement heifers.
Sandy Johnson's a Kansas State beef reproduction specialist talking about the importance of the third trimester.
That means the start of their third trimester is early November. So November, December, we need to be, you know, making a plan. And obviously we do have some later calving herds as well. But, you know, when you put those bulls in, so that tells you when you should start calving. And you need to know when the third trimester starts for your cows and manage accordingly. And unfortunately, when we look at our NOMS data, even in the large herds, only 30% of producers say they use body condition scoring. So an underutilized tool, and really encourage people to use this simple planning to help reduce cost and improve cow performance.
But some in the herd may never make it to the third trimester if we encounter nitrate poisoning. Dr. Greg Hanselcheck's a Kansas State veterinarian.
We recommend that any forage that, whether it's brome or just native grass, if there is a fair, which are not accumulators of nitrates, but if there's weeds in there, highly recommend that those are sampled for nitrate levels. Any of your sorghum, sorghum sedan, corn, oat hay is one we don't talk enough about. Any of those products, we highly recommend that a nitrate level is determined on those products. It only costs $10 to $15. And you can really save some animals by testing the forages. Our tox group actually has a compound that's based on sulfuric acid, so we can't ship it. We can't ship it through any shipping thing, but we've provided it to a lot of county extension agents in Kansas. And it's just, we take like a corn stalk, open it up, put this solution on there. If it turns a certain color, then that means there's nitrates there. So if producers want a quick, rapid test to see if they have nitrates, take some of those products into the county extension agent and see if they have this compound. If it's positive, we still highly recommend that they sample that forage, send it into a laboratory so that they get a level of nitrates. This thing's just going to say whether nitrate's there or not. It's not going to tell you whether it's high or low.
And what are some final thoughts?
Nitrates are accumulating in the bottom 6 inches of the plant. So, I mean, in a drought situation, we want as much forage harvested as possible, but if you leave the bottom 6 inches in the field, that's a way to harvest the forages and reduce the amount of nitrate in the product. The other thing, if we can make it into silage and we do a good job of putting it up in the right moisture and packing it and all that, and it goes through a good fermentation process, it'll lose 30 to 50% of the nitrates. One thing I didn't mention before we got on here is that nitrates in a baled forage will not disappear in time. Meaning if you bale high nitrate round bales this year, next year if you feed them, they're still going to be high in nitrates. So it doesn't go away in time like prussic acid and some of our other toxins do. We rarely see the nitrate levels in our forages high enough where we can't use it. You can design rations and dilute it with low nitrate forages so that it'll be safe to the animals. We may say we don't want to feed this to pregnant animals, but to anybody else, we can. I would keep it in mind every year just because we see so much of it. And you're right, this year, I think at one time, 98% of the state of Kansas was considered to be in a drought situation. And drought situations a lot of times promote the accumulation of nitrates in the plants. So this year was especially bad. So this year, any forage that was harvested, I would test it for nitrates. And then in the subsequent years, just do it as needed.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Stillwater FFA of Oklahoma was named the 2023 Model of Excellence winner with Ryan Crosswaite. He is an FFA member of the chapter. So tell me more about what this means to your chapter.
This is something that our chapter has been striving for many years now, actually. We had the opportunity, we were blessed, Kiriana, Trinity, and I, when we were able to be picked for this team. This was an honor. He came to us, our FFA advisor, Mr. Robbie Branscombe. He came to us and he was like, hey, we really want you guys for this team. This would be a really cool opportunity to talk about the activities that we did. Last year was a big year for us. We did a lot of new things and we did a lot of old things that we did and we changed and tweaked and that we really enjoyed. We did a 5K race. We had a firefighter meeting where we learned about safety for fires. We did What's a Farmer Day, and that was a fourth grade ag day for students to come out and learn about different agriculture pursuits. And that's just to name a few of the different things that we did. But it just means a whole lot to us. Our chapter as a whole works really, really hard every day to get to where we are today. And we're super, super proud of the rest of our chapter.
Tell me about some of those activities.
So like I mentioned earlier, our 5K race is one of our bigger ones. This is an activity that we bring in our community. And we asked for 20 cans worth of donations in order to run this race instead of a traditional money donation. We asked for 20 cans and we raised almost 5,000 cans this past year. And we are the single largest donator of cans in our community in Stillwater, which is a really big deal. We're also with the Oklahoma State University, and all the sororities and fraternities also do this. So being the largest donator of cans is super, super big for us. We did planter boxes. We gave back to our community by giving planter boxes in exchange for two $25 gift cards. Our members then shopped at these places, returned in gift card receipts to be drawn for these prizes that were given through the gift cards. So this is a way to impact our community financially. We did the cans, and we also gave back to our community with knowledge. We had a fourth grade ag day through what we call What's a Farmer, and where we have fourth grade students from six local elementary schools. Almost 500 students came through our ag barn and had six different stations that they went through. And we talked about different practices of agriculture that the public often sometimes overlooks and they frown upon. So this was an opportunity to give back to the community through knowledge within our younger generation.
And another activity you did was about safety with firefighters. Tell me a little more.
Yeah, so this was actually an activity that we pitched through our Shark Tank activity. And this came about from our chapter president last year, Abigail Burton. She's actually the daughter of two firefighters. And she saw the need that, hey, we don't have fire safety like we should. So we had a meeting. We went through a bunch of different stations teaching, you know, hands-on interactions, blowing the fire hose out of the fire hydrant. So it was really powerful. It was really cool to see what the firefighters have to do. We towed a fire truck by hand, which was super, super hard. I don't recommend doing that by yourself. I tried. I thought I about died, but it's okay. And so then we had them sign a fire safety pledge where we got to see students really engage and really learn about the different fire hazards and things to do to prevent it.
So you had mentioned, I don't recommend doing it yourself. I know for all these activities, it takes a team. Tell me more a little bit about the team efforts.
Yes, absolutely. So like going through our POA, we had 15 committees that were consisted of many, many students. I don't know the exact number, but I'd guess probably 150, 160 students were able to get in on this action, get in on the different committees. Trinity and Kiriana both were very active last year in our chapter, and we were able to see different students that had never really had a leadership role step forward and have that opportunity to really lead a small team of students for the larger goal.
It takes a team to be the top honor for the chapter at the national level. Lasting comments about this award.
We are beyond blessed with our three FFA advisors that were able to really help us get to where we are today. We wouldn't be where we are without them. But also the team that's behind the officers. Our officer team is awesome. We work really, really hard to get to where we are. But our members are what make us succeed and are the foot and what really hold us together as a chapter. So we're super, super thankful for the opportunity to even be here today.
That was Ryan Crosswhat and Trinity Lush of the Stillwater FFA in Oklahoma. They were named the 2023 Model of Excellence winner at the 96th National FFA Convention and Expo. For National FFA, I'm Michelle Stengler.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
With Congress still working to approve a new fiscal year budget before the latest continuing resolution ends on November 17th, what are the chances of a 2023 farm bill being approved and signed into law by the end of the year? In the opinion of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack,
we're not going to have a farm bill passed before December 31st.
Yet he also acknowledges an extension of the current farm bill is then needed.
Because we don't want the program to lapse, because if it were to lapse, there would be serious consequences to the farmers, but also very serious consequences to the economy and to consumers.
The secretary, speaking at this year's National FFA Convention, says the question then pertaining to an extension is its length of time.
I think the Senate leadership, in a bipartisan way, is suggesting a year. Don't know if the House has got that same timeline, but I think the House is also recognizes they're not going to get it done before December 31st.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.